Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on all of our most recent podcasts. I also wrote a book that I'll be putting on Amazon soon. It's called Content About Content. You can guess what it's about. It's a bunch of essays about things that would be called content. Any hoops, let's get to the episode. All right, James.
All right.
Happy day. You convinced me to do another Adam Sandler movie.
You know what? I think the Safdie brothers convinced you to do another Adam Sandler movie. Because, this was a movie that won a lot of people over, not just people like myself who are long time and sometimes begrudging admirers of Adam Sandler.
Yes. Yes. This is a... I would say it's a very well-liked movie by the people that saw it, for the most part. I also saw it with somebody who absolutely hated it, and there's no shortage of those people, but the majority of people that saw it tend to really have enjoyed it.
Yeah, and we're,
it's
we're
talking
about
Uncut
Gems.
Yeah. We're out of practice. It's been a while.
It's true. I told someone that it's worth a watch, and then they were telling someone to maybe come over and watch it, and they asked what the movie was, and they didn't recognize the title. They said it's an Adam Sandler movie, and I said, well, that's true, but that's not really a fair way to describe this movie to someone.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it is very funny at times, and despite the fact that it's not Adam Sandler's first mostly drama film, and not even his first extremely well-received mostly drama film. Mm-hmm. It's a wild one. It's a very different movie. I can see people absolutely hating it, for sure. Mm-hmm. It's such a mood, and it's such a big swing, and it definitely just has a pretty unrelenting vibe. So if you are not liking what you're seeing, it really just kind of gets pounded at you over and over. So I absolutely understand not liking this, but I do see why so many different people are liking it and finding a lot of different reasons to like it too.
Yeah, for sure. And I, the way that I, when people would talk to me about Uncut Gems, having them not having seen it, them trying to ask what it's about, what to expect. My first question was always, did you see Good Time, which is the Safdie brothers' previous movie? And, that was my first experience with the Safdies. I also feel like that's probably their most aggressive movie until Uncut Gems. But I remember coming out of Good Time and being like, that felt like a 2-hour panic attack. And I feel that Uncut Gems is like that, but cranked up to 11. And so when I found somebody who, in your case, you hadn't seen Good Time, right?
No,
I was very, very pleased to be able to sit next to you in a movie theater while you saw this movie, because it's such a, if you haven't seen Good Time, then you haven't seen a movie like this. And it's really fun to watch this movie with an audience full of, I know I'm speaking from a place of being able to do this because I think I lived in the only city where Uncut Gems was easy to see in a theater, the only city in Canada. But just to hear an audience full of people start to parse what the style of this movie is, and it's just like, oh, I guess they're just really going to be totally unrelenting as the movie's going. And just at the end of the movie, especially the final big moment is, I saw this movie 4 times in a theater, and 3 out of the 4 times, the last gunshot in the movie made somebody either gasp or yell out, whoa! Like, it was, it's just great. It's great to hear people figure out the movie in real time, like, as it's happening. And it's really fun to be in a movie theater as this movie ends, you know? And it was also, like, it did really well. And I saw it in full theater, like, not full, but full-ish theaters 3 times, and it was a blast every time, and even the sparser theater the 4th time was still fun, you know?
So, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and also the second shot of this movie is, like, you know, you start with that drone shot in Ethiopia, and the second shot is a close-up of an exposed broken bone, and you tend to get some people audibly noticing what type of movie this is going to be on that edit, you know? And that's fun to hear.
Yeah, Yeah, and so I mean it's a good place to start because it is the beginning. That's just, even an aside from a pretty gory injury, it's an unpleasant scene in the sense that it's very, there's people just yelling at each other. There's no subtitles, it's not in English, so you're not really sure what's going on, but it's, extremely evident that they're disagreeing about something or upset about something. And so you really get thrown into it again with no subtitles, and then so those two workers kind of take it upon themselves to use this opportunity to go and get to go and find the opal on their own. And then I remember not knowing if that was going to be that level of sort of aggression right off the top, was just kind of a hook to get you engaged, a bit of violence right off the start and a bit of really kind of frantic high energy stuff. Because then there's that, it's a much quieter part of the scene when they go and get the opal. And then we get that micro photography intro where you're traveling through the opal and has, kind of unique music, but not unpleasant. It's sort of it's synthetic and kind of dreamy. It's not the most typical music for a movie of this time, but it's pleasant. And then that smooth transition into the really unpleasant colonoscopy footage, it just switches back and forth on you really quickly right off the start. And I, just trying to figure out what movie it is one thing, but I just find it does get you really engaged right off the bat. And then for the rest of the film, it's pretty frenetic, and that pace kind of from the beginning is more of the common pace. But there are some moments of, quiet that really, I think, resonate a lot. And I think some of those quieter things get looked over because the thing you have to talk about and the thing that we have kind of opened up talking about is just how propulsive and kinetic the movie is. But it certainly does the other parts well as well.
Oh, for sure. And I think anytime you're doing a movie that is like swells like this movie does, you also have to have moments where the audience has to exhale at some point. Like even like a big budget action movie that's like really great and really intense, like Mission Impossible Fallout is the last action movie that everybody agrees was really, really enjoyable and really, really intense. You have to have that scene where Ving Rhames sits down with Michelle Monaghan and they talk for a minute, and that scene has to work. And different examples of that exist in this movie, and even the like the scenes where Ratner is at home with his family are the ones that jump out. And the talking about the what you're describing, the sort of like slowdown after we're in Ethiopia when we travel into 2012, basically like the opening credit sequence of this movie, when Howard's just walking through and living about going through his day, like after that appointment, is so aggressive and intense. And it's just like him walking around and just shouting at people at his cell phone, shouting at people that may or may not be there on the street. And just the music is so intense. Like the percussion in it is unrelenting. And in any other movie, it just feels like, all right, this is a guy walking around just doing stuff. In this movie, it's like, I don't know if I can take another 5 minutes of this, let alone another 2 hours of it, because it's a 2 hour, 15 minute movie. So it's, I don't know, it's great. And just throwing you into like, this is what, I think it does a really good job of throwing you into who Howard Ratner is, and just being like, yes, this is Adam Sandler, but this is Adam Sandler in this movie, And I think with somebody who is as famous as Adam Sandler is and has the particular sort of perception about him that he does in general, like the general perception of him, I think it's really important to have a sequence like that where you get what Sandler is in this movie, but you also get some really good moments of comedy in that scene, like when Julia says, "Come on, I know you want to cuddle." Like the facial expression he makes right there is so funny and so perfect, and that's just a perfect example of something that I think somebody like Sandler brings to this movie that like somebody who's not a 20-plus year movie star would be able to bring, and I don't know. I think they just do a really good job of not only setting up this world, but setting up the person and setting up the fact that Adam Sandler's not playing an Adam or not playing a typical Adam Sandler character in this movie.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that there's things about him that make the like this version of Howard good, but I think you're right in that, along with setting up the world really well, that intro kind of just gets you to shake off some preconceived Adam Sandler notions. And that's more important with him as an actor than someone who is a bit more of a chameleon, outside of I don't know, you don't mess with the Zohan or something. He often plays pretty similar people. So
Yeah, like if this, I mean, I know he's dead, but if this is a Philip Seymour Hoffman role, you don't need that intro as much as you do with somebody like Sandler.
Yeah, that's right, for sure. And I even just because we talked about the colonoscopy, I think it's important to mention that that is, it's kind of over this whole movie as this cancer risk. It starts with it, and he eventually, in maybe one of the most insane scenes, like tough to handle, just by the amount of stuff that's happening. He gets his diagnosis, and he finds out that he's clear and that he's safe from his concerns of this disease. But it's not really talked about much, and it's really kind of put on the back burner. And it's just because there's so much else happening, and you never get the sense that he wants to get this money so his family's future could be safe if he's about to die. Like, you don't even have, I guess Walter White's a good example, even though we kind of learn that he starts seeing other things about being a drug kingpin that he likes. It seems quite clear at the beginning that he's doing it for the right reasons, where the pursuit of money and the pursuit of a successful gambling ticket really isn't about his future. And you kind of get a sense it's not even about accumulating wealth. It's about winning, as he says. Like, this is when he's talking to Kevin Garnett about making these deals for these diamonds and things like that, and the big deal he made with the opal. Like, that's how he wins in his world. And I think that you just get the sense that the money is everything, but it's also kind of nothing to him. It's about being smarter than the bookie, or being smarter than whoever shipped him this opal, or being smarter than whoever he's selling a watch to,
No, and I think that conversation with KG, the last scene KG has in the movie, is I would say the most important scene of the movie as far as like the meaning of this movie. So we'll come back to that. But you're right. And something that I don't think I realized is like it doesn't seem like Julia or his family seem to know about Howard having this appointment. Like Dina, I don't think Dina ever brings it up to him, his wife,
No.
and somebody in his
And she
office.
might treat him differently if he had.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
Like,
it
and
wouldn't
just the way she
solve
treats
every
him.
relationship problem.
Yeah, exactly. Like she would, it wouldn't solve their problems, but it would, she wouldn't be as mean to him probably if she knew about it, right? And at least temporarily. And same with Julia. It doesn't seem like Julia knows. Somebody, whoever the woman is who charges his phone whenever he comes back into the office, she knows he was at the doctor. But that seems to be like the only hint that another human being other than his own doctor knows about this. So you're right that it is something that's sort of running through the movie without ever really getting any clarity. And it's not like, and Howard doesn't even really celebrate it when he finds out, like, it's not an issue. It's just like, I've already got these other 40 things to deal with. Damani is pouring like Powerade in with my fish right now. I gotta sort this out. So, but yeah, no, you are right that it is something that, like, I think there are a lot of little things running throughout this movie that are never really discussed, and they're just kind of there. And the whole, it feels like the idea of this movie is to throw as much at you, just like Howard is doing, partially to himself and partially because of the world around him. And then it's just like, grab what you can, like you're gonna be overwhelmed and just see what you can get out of it, And it seems like the Safdie brothers, Ben and Josh, care more about you having like a really, like a, I don't want, like, I was going to say good experience. I don't know if it's a good experience. Like, it's just
No,
having an experience watching this movie. And then if you really, really like it, there's stuff that you can look for and grab onto. Because I do think this movie is has a lot going
immersive.
for it. Yeah, very immersive. And I think there's plenty to think about in this movie when you're not watching this movie. It's not just like this ride, which I think a lot of people tend to sort of think it is. But yeah, they care more about it working as a ride, and then trust that if it does work for you like that, then you will go back and think about the things that they've thrown at you, like the cancer thing that you're discussing, and certainly the conversation with KG. That's sort of the one moment where they're like, we're stopping the movie to say something.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, because it certainly is a ride as well, and I've just been thinking about this and thinking about who to recommend it to and what they'd like about it. And people work so hard to try to avoid stress that it seems odd to kind of invite so much of it into your life with a movie like this. But it's, as you like, you know, you describe this as kind of a 2-hour and 50-minute panic attack, and panic attacks aren't fun. But it's, I guess it's just that idea of being so engaged with something, like with having it take up so much of your focus and really engage your brain at such a deep level, that that trick doesn't, like, you can't just do that. You can't just have endless like music and voices and violence without it being constructed properly, because then you really get numb to it. But this does walk that fine line of, yes, there are 3 phone calls happening at once and people talking to each other all over this diamond store, and he's got bets going and this cancer and a home life and a second domestic life with Julia that you're actually concerned about. I mean, he has all these things that you're actually concerned about, that it has to be put together really meticulously for it not just to be overwhelming to the point that you check out. And knowing and just reading about how much time and effort they put into this, and kind of had a bit of a dry run, it sounds like, with Good Times. Not that that movie didn't mean anything to them, obviously, because they seem like extremely passionate people. But just the idea that before, even before Kevin Garnett was on or signed on, they had different NBA players, and they would rewrite the whole script just for something that was more relevant to Kobe Bryant or whoever was going to play it. Because there's several other people lined up. It's so well crafted and so well edited, and that's something that people don't always notice, editing and sound design. But when it's done this well, and it carries a lot of the heavyweight in a movie as this does, it's kind of just undeniable that that's something that really plays a part, even if it's not something that most people think about all the time.
Yeah, for
including
sure,
myself.
Yeah, and I think the things that we can point to, this movie is just incredibly well crafted, you know. And what you're saying is 100% right. Like, there are the elements of craft that people tend to not notice, because it's not like there's the really incredible one-er that opens Boogie Nights. You know, it's not, those are the things that everybody's like, oh, that's filmmaking. I can point to that and be like, this is incredible filmmaking, because there's so many moving elements and I can see them all. Whereas this, it's more, so the easiest comparison point for this movie and Good Times specifically is like the way that they use sound and zooms and camera movement is kind of like Robert Altman, where, you know, if you watch something like The Long Goodbye, I think every shot in The Long Goodbye is either slowly zooming in or slowly zooming out. And Altman was very famous for his use of sound and overlapping sound specifically. And the Safdies have been pretty vocal about him being an influence on them that way. And I also feel an element of Paul Greengrass in this movie as well. Again, the camera work is not as aggressive, but sort of the way that they hit with sounds is so so intense. And like, if you watch a Bourne movie, every sound effect in that movie is way too loud in like the reality of when you stop and think about it. Just like in Uncut Gems, every sound effect is louder than it should be. And I just sort of feel like that ups the level of aggressiveness throughout the movie. And what you're saying about the Safdies, this movie's been through so many iterations. It was rewritten for at least, I think, 3 different NBA players. The Kobe Bryant thing ended up being a misdirect. Somebody reached out saying that he was looking for film work, but then they found out later he wasn't looking to be an actor. So they kind of rewrote it for Kobe for nothing. They had Amari Stoudemire for a while, because then you could have put it when he was a Knick. And they also had Joel Embiid for a while. So they're rewriting it for all of these people. I think of those players, they got the best one in Kevin Garnett. And also, like, you know, the Adam Sandler was their original intention when they first wrote the screenplay in like 2009, but they couldn't get him onto it for a long time until they made Good Time. Good Time is what got them Sandler, basically. But there was a point where they were going to make this movie with Sacha Baron Cohen, and they rewrote it for him, and they were going to do it a almost like quasi-Borat style. And even like that's a totally different movie. Like you think about it, and it would be similar, but still totally different. And I think the main skill that the Safdies seem to have is harnessing impulse. You know, like it just they're so, and you can hear it. They're so quick and energetic it when they're interviewing, and it's like it almost seems difficult for one of them to stop talking so that the other one can start talking. And it's really, they have a really interesting dynamic, and which is like the exact opposite of the Coen brothers, you know, they're probably the most famous sibling filmmakers. And I don't know, it's really interesting that their true skill seems to be being open to everything at all times. And I think this movie is something where you're open to seeing something in the world that's better than what your idea was. And that's the main positive thing I can give about this or say about this movie is that there's no way this is the movie that was scripted. And there's also no way the scripted movie is better than this movie, you know? And I think that's this really hard sort of ethereal thing to describe, but it's kind of the thing that's impossible to describe in filmmaking. And that's why we gravitate so much towards film grammar. Just because we can point to something and explain why it's good. Whereas Uncut Gems, I can't quite get there because I don't think anybody can. And I just think that's like it's the extra little bit of filmmaking that is just impossible to describe, you know? Like, and I think
Yeah, no, I
their
think
street casting is an important part of that, like all of the supporting characters in this movie.
Yeah, no, I think it's coming across what you mean. And I think, yeah, that the idea that I'm harnessing impulse, even as like maximalist as this is sometimes, you can tell they always could just they could do more all the time, even though there's so much in here. But yeah, the idea of having to write this for so many people and taking suggestions from actors and, as you said, finding people to fill those kind of smaller roles. Since seeing this, you and I have joked about some people who have, you know, four lines in this movie or one line and it being so good. And those the kitchen scene with Dina and Marcel's daughter after the play.
Oh, so good.
One of those quiet scenes and not a ton of dialogue, but you just get the sense of years of family drama being communicated and just like the mother and daughter looking at each other and saying so much with just their eyes. Like there is, even in some of the slower things,
Well, and in that
you
scene,
just get this idea of a whole world.
for sure. And in that sequence, the daughter says literally three times, and like in a scene that's probably a minute long. And that's something about that just feels so real to me in like such a funny way. And you listen to interviews with the Safdies, and they were talking about doing table reads. And I sort of lump them together. I never know when Josh is speaking or Ben is speaking. Like they're just the Safdies. Whoever was in charge of keeping the script going would just have his laptop open and be rewriting dialogue as actors would perform it. Like if they threw something in that was just better. Like they felt like it's sort of like they write these roles, and they're not the only filmmakers that would do this, but you know, you write these roles and then you give it to the actor, and they're very open to what the actor is going to do with it, and they want to build the movie around what their collaborators are going to do with it. Like they want it to sort of be a real collaboration, as opposed to I give Aaron Sorkin's the one that's popping to mind. It's just like no, the dialogue is this, and you say it like this. Like it's just how it goes, and I think that's really cool. And I think I mean, actors love it. I think the another recent example of a movie that was sort of like, here's the script, but go play with it and we'll see what happens is The Irishman in a totally different way. But it's just like, yeah, I got Joe Pesci, I got Robert De Niro, I got Al Pacino. They know what they're gonna do, and their ideas are about acting are better than mine, you know? And I think that was the really cool thing about that movie. And the Safdies and Uncut Gems, it's kind of a different version of the same thing. And Just to point, bring it back to like what I'm saying about understanding, or sorry, being open to things. The other thing that I just want to make very clear is that the Safdies have an incredible level of craft. Like the filmmaking, the style that they do it comes across as very impulsive. And I know they're shooting two cameras all at the same time, but they're not shooting like for the edit. So they're not shooting shots that would necessarily match up in the edit, which is just like, it seems to make the editing the movie in my head would make it more difficult, you know, than making it easier. Whereas like if you're quote unquote shooting two cameras for the edit, chances are you have like a wide shot and a close up that would then work intercut. Whereas by what I can pick up, it sounds like they're just shooting two cameras, one of which is whatever shot they've decided, like close up of Adam Sandler as he's walking around his office. And then the second one is just, shooting details or something that don't necessarily cut. I don't even know. I haven't even been able to figure it out. But they do have an incredible level of craft with that and with the sound. And Darius Kanji is the cinematographer on this movie. Highly, highly, highly respected cinematographer whose bona fides have been proven time and time again. It's sort of... This movie looks like it was made by the people who made Good Time, but it looks like it was made by the people who made Good Time who also found like the perfect collaborator. And Darius Kanji doesn't have a movie that looks like this because what other movie looks like this? You know, like that's something that I think one of the most positive things I can say about the cinematography in Uncut Gems is like, name me a second movie that looks like Uncut Gems. Cinematography, production design, all of these things. There's just something so like garish and rugged about the whole movie, but it's also beautiful. And there are just these little bits that it just seems like must be like Darius Kanji adding like a little bit to what the Safdies had intended. Like, you know, when Kevin Garnett's leaning on the glass in the jewelry shop and how they have that purple lighting coming up from where the jewelry is, like just the way it lights the bottom of faces. And you can see it a little bit on Howard, but just the darker skin, you can see it a lot more. And that, and the goddamn orange sweatshirt that Dumani's wearing in the, in the nightclub scene.
In the weekend.
It's so good. The way that like the orange is just reflecting on Howard's face. It's so incredible. And I was listening to an interview with Darius Kanji and he said, like, I didn't light Adam Sandler in that scene. I just lit the room and let the sweatshirt do the rest. He's talking about like when they found that sweatshirt. And he's like, this is, we're using this in the scene. And it's just, it's so cool. I love it. It's such a beautiful, like, beautifully ugly movie, and it's great. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think The Weeknd should get some credit for demanding the black light for that scene.
Well, okay, so yes, one, that's one of the funniest moments in this movie because that's just like objectively funny. But can we talk about this as a period piece a little bit? Because that's kind of, I think that's.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Also, how far in the past does something have to take place for it to be called a period piece? You know, does 8 years count?
Yeah, I don't know what the cutoff line is. I would guess no, but yeah. I think it's still very interesting. And yeah, the idea of this being written around real basketball games within our lifetime is obviously interesting to see how that looks. But I didn't mean to derail you from the
no,
period
no, it's
piece.
Fine. I'm now thinking about this because I feel like people would talk about Lady Bird like a period piece, which takes place in 2002, I think. But yeah, I can see how maybe we're not quite far enough. I guess the world still looks pretty much pretty similar to the Uncut Gems world. But anyway.
Yeah.
The thing that, and I think The Weeknd is just perfect for this, because where The Weeknd is in 2012, he's still like this this cool unknown, you know. And I mean, I lived in Toronto when The Weeknd was sort of just starting to exist, and nobody knew who his name was. He didn't give interviews for like a year. He had a show at Mod Club that was like a thing that people like cared a lot about. And this whole thing of like it's kind of, I still think it exists in his music, this extremely faux, like, aura of cool, like, world of drugs and partying and slow grooves and about not giving a fuck, basically. And that's very present in all of his music, especially at this time. And to have him sort of playing himself, singing this particular song that he does, which is perfect for this movie because it's of those songs that he was performing at the time. It's, the song is called The Morning. It's the one that's the best, but it's also not, it wasn't the most popular, which I think is important for the Uncut Gems audience. It has to be like sort of the backup option. But then to have him say he's not going to perform without the black light is so fun because it's him pointing, poking fun at the own, like sort of his own sort of, how much he cared about image at the time, and probably like still does to an extent, but it's just more open. Like he's now famous enough that, you know, you can only protect your image so much, but I just think it's so funny to hear, him say I'm not performing without a black light. It's just, oh, it's great. And I can't think of a second artist who would have fit this place as well as he does. And with Kevin Garnett, again, also perfect, but if you just look at where Kevin Garnett is in his career, and you look at where The Weeknd is in their career, right? Like Kevin Garnett, he's in the Hall of Fame by this point. You know, like there's nothing Kevin Garnett can do in the NBA that would make his Hall of Fame case, like would take him out of the Hall of Fame, unless I suppose he started gambling on sports, P. Rose style. But
right,
which, as far as I know, he did not do. But he's very, very much like the
or showed up with a Furby necklace,
which as and like he's basically the old head trying to hold on. And this Celtics team, this is like the last real gasp of that team that. They were in the game 7 of the finals 2 years before this, but even at that time, it felt like the last gasp of that team. And now we're 2 years later and they're still holding on. And it's sort of like, it's this team of old people who are just holding on and refusing to lose. And they lose to the Heat in 7 games in the next series. Like they were right on the precipice of making the finals again. And it's just so interesting that I think he really mirrors Howard. Like he's willing to do whatever it takes to win. He's doing it on a basketball court, but the opal seems to be very important to his success, at least in his mind. And I think he really mirrors the Howard's predicament in sort of a less ethical, cloudy way. Because I don't think KG is really ethically cloudy in this movie at all. I just think he's just a person living his life, and I don't think he does anything like particularly good. I don't think he does anything particularly bad. And you sort of look at The Weeknd as a representation of what Howard is afraid of, right? Because they talk about, you brought up the Furby. The Furby, they joke about how that's not selling, you know, and they talk about how Howard used to outfit rappers for music videos, I believe. I believe they mentioned that just almost in passing. I think Damani says it. And that immediately made me think of, given the time period, like you flash back 10 years previous to when this movie takes place, the early 2000s, you've got this guy. Are you familiar with the guy, Jacob the Jeweler? Does that ring a bell to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Because he gets name dropped in about 400 hip hop songs from about 1995 to 2005. And he was just like, he's the only jeweler I can name, you know, still to this day, because
right.
As far as I know, he's the only like personal jeweler that Kanye has mentioned in a song. And he had this sort of like weird fame. I did some research. He ended up going to jail for money laundering in like 2006 for a couple of years. And that sort of just, I think, really reflects to me Howard, in that he's willing to do anything to hold on to what he has, but his time might have already passed, you know? And that's sort of a bit of a stretch, but I think it was just an interesting connection. And I know the Safdies have mentioned Howard being based on a lot of people in the Diamond District, but I have heard them mention Jacob the Jeweler, at least in passing, and I thought that was interesting, an interesting element.
Yeah, and then him being concerned about The Weeknd kind of representing someone, you know, younger.
Oh, for sure.
Kind of moving the way up, and then we have that fight out on the street after he discovers him spending time with Julia. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, they're only doing coke.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and even the like piece of jewelry that each person cares about, the opal for Kevin Garnett and the Michael Jackson piece for The Weeknd. Like, Howard cares so much less about The Weeknd's piece. You know, he just sort of views it as small potatoes when realistically, like, you should probably keep an eye on him, you know? He's a star boy.
That's right.
Yeah, he's a star boy in waiting.
Very true.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the period piece thing, I've actually been thinking about that. I think that I think smartphones make it a hard thing to make it a fully separate time, and that obviously is going to go away because in 50 years, things that were 50 years ago will be a period piece, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But I think that's something that still makes it feel pretty contemporary, and I want to talk about their use. I love that Howard has plenty of typos and is not good at typing on his phone.
For sure.
Especially at that scene of him in her closet, by the way, is so weirdly uncomfortable. But I really enjoy that. And the idea of miscommunication is kind of looped throughout this movie. Like, as I said, in that kitchen scene, there's a lot being said or a lot being communicated that's not being said. But then just people being either misheard or, you know, when his employee's trying to quit the first time he gets his hands on the opal, and you hear someone speaking so passionately, and they've probably had this conversation in their head over and over, and now they're being explicit about it, and it's just, it's hitting a brick wall. You know, this person, Howard, is not even remotely listening, and there is so much communication here that either gets misinterpreted or just completely stonewalled.
For sure. And there's also a lot of communicating that Howard is doing to seemingly nobody at all. I don't know, he seems to just like saying his thoughts out loud when nobody could really conceivably hear them. And communication is certainly an element of this movie that Howard may or may not take into consideration, you know, like whether or not he's being listened to. But I found that interesting about him in general, and I didn't know if it was something that like the Safdies are like, we just need more sound, or if it's sort of a character aspect, you know.
But no one has talked in 0.75 seconds.
Exactly. I have a question for you about Adam Sandler, as somebody who has seen more Adam Sandler movies than I have.
Sure.
I think we can comfortably settle on.
Okay. Yep.
So does he? So,
no, you've just seen more movies than I have.
I know, but I think this is a
subgenre.
One of the few genres where you have the lead. It's this and movies about the NFL draft where you're ahead of nothing else.
You can solve that in 90 fun minutes. But don't worry about it.
From the director of Ghostbusters. Anywho, he's walking with like a little bit of a hunch in his neck almost. Like, does Adam Sandler always, like, he has sort of like this hunch to his back. Is that like an always thing, or is that a Howard Ratner thing? Because I was really curious about that.
He is not one for great posture, but I think what you're talking about here is not the case. I think he's, you know, he's obviously not a young man anymore, but I think he's trying to play older in this. Mm-hmm. He put on some weight. I think he just tries to hunch a bit more and look a bit sloppier, which is interesting because with he never really stops exposing his teeth in this. And I think it's just, you know what I mean? Even here in the way he speaks, you can tell his like upper lip is like tight up against his gum to expose his front teeth. And because I think he's got fake nice teeth. And I think it is part of who he is that is something he spends money on and needs it to be seen frequently. And even though it interferes with the way that he communicates, and he does sound goofy and he doesn't sound like he sounds in every other movie, I think it's one thing that adds to the unique look and sound of the character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree, and I think he's, I don't know, it does feel like a performance that only one person could give, and I say that positively, like as a compliment. And I really enjoyed the, you know, I didn't notice the posture thing really. It didn't really jump out at me until I was like watching it with a notebook for this podcast. And you know, I love posture acting, and if this is like so subtle that I could not really notice it for four viewings and then notice it on the fifth. I think that's some real props to the Sandman. And I mean, admittedly, there are very few wide shots in this movie, so it's you really have to look for it. But I don't know. I just thought it was an interesting element, and I like the. I think it really fits Howard, like the idea of sort of being slumped over. Yeah.
Why?
It's almost like he's got his guard up. You know, like it. Like he feels like it's he feels like exposed, you know, it's sort of like a turtle trying to put their head in their into their shell sort of thing constantly.
Yeah.
Again, very slight, but it just something about him not having perfect posture really, really fits to me. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's right because I do think in the way that you're talking about this cinematography, kind of mixing a lot of beautiful things with ugly things, I think even just this representation of the diamond business, mm-hmm. You know, there's obviously things that are so inherently glamorous about it. You know, they're literally precious gems and the amount of money and, you know, very shiny, pretty objects and, you know, pretty people selling them. And, you know, they put a lot of money into their clothes and their showrooms and all this stuff. But you obviously see the underside of it and the not very glamorous stuff and the violence and the mm-hmm. lies. And yeah, I think that, you know, combining his bad posture with his insistence on showing these nice teeth all the time, I think is just one other example of them mixing kind of high and low things. And I think it's effective. And I think that you're right that when the fact that he just personally embodies it through his acting, I think is, just a really good bit of acting.
Yeah, no, agreed. Do you have anything else you feel compelled to mention about Mr. Sandler while we're here in the Sandler corner?
Oh, no, I think it's I think people have been appreciative of mm-hmm. him this time around. Mm-hmm. I think every time he does something like this, people are just baffled by how he slums it on movies that you know, are less well critically received.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy for him, and I thought he was good in this. And you know, it was maybe almost Jonah Hill or Sacha Baron Cohen, two people I like, especially Sacha. Mm-hmm. So I bet those would have been fantastic movies too. But as you said, those would be different movies, and this was better than my roll of the dice on what this movie was going to be. Same thing with Kevin Garnett. Like, I don't know how Joel Embiid or Mari Stoudemire would have been, but if this is the athlete performance that we got, it's better than the average, better than expected. So yeah. I'm just going to be happy about the way it turned out.
Watch Trainwreck again and you'll be happy Omari wasn't the guy that they cast.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
All due respect to Omari Stoudemire, who I enjoy as a human being and also... in general, don't think he's a bad actor, but KG is so good in this movie. He's so perfect. But yeah, I one thing that I do like thinking about with this movie and specifically Sandler is like, I would be really curious to know how this movie, I mean, it would have been a totally different movie, obviously, but like if this some sort of version of this movie was released in like the year 2000 with Sandler still as the lead. And because I really feel like, I think this is an iconic performance in some capacity, but it would have been like in the movie going environment of 2000, if this movie was a success with Adam Sandler, where he was in 2000, it just like, I don't know, like it would be a performance that everybody would have had to talk about at some point if they cared about movies at all. You know, I don't necessarily say like Daniel Plainview or something and There Will Be Blood, but I think something like that, just because it's such a unique performance and it's so engaging and there's just, I don't know. There's something about it that I wish there could be more Howard Ratner in my life. And I understand part of the appeal of this movie is that it has an ending. You know, that's the thing I like about movies instead of television. They have endings.
Howard Ratner has a pretty definitive ending in this one.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. It's really interesting to me to think about, like, what if this was... if this falls in the release calendar in the place of like Punch Drunk Love, you know, it just would have been really interesting. Yeah.
But. Yeah. And who knows if he would have had the capability then.
Oh no, I agree. And again, like I'm mentioned, I think Punch Drunk Love comes out in 2002, which is 10 years before this movie takes place. You know? So it's like there's a million things that are impossible about this movie being released in the year 2000 or 2002. But I don't know. It's just it is interesting to think about because I do think like in a different movie going environment and a less even of the very recent past, even 2012, I think this performance becomes even more iconic than it is.
Yeah, oh, I think it'll do just fine though. And I
No,
think
yeah.
it'll be a great feather in the cap.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's certainly my favorite Sandler performance, and I like Punch Drunk Love quite a bit. So,
Yeah.
has
What do you think of the what do you make of the title?
I don't know. I think we're still on James Corder here talking about the meaning of titles and
Direct
names.
titles. Yeah, no, I just think it's sort of what we touched on with that desire that exists in Howard and in Kevin Garnett and maybe in Arno and Nico and Phil and everybody else who acts in
Everybody
Lord
else is
Julia.
whose name ends with a Z, an O.
Oh, yeah, I was gonna say kind of anyone who acts in extreme ways throughout this movie, of which there's a lot of people, just a lot of very driven people, for better or worse, typically for worse. That that's the thing he's looking for, is that when he says this is how I win, he's looking for something that is perfection, some uncut gem, something that is still kind of pure and perfect and probably unobtainable. It's something that's always going to be chased, but at no point do you get the sense that these people are going to be like, well, good, got it, that's it, that's enough money, or that's enough games, or that's enough power within the New York underground crime scene. Like you and the fact that we so quickly get that combination of the inside of the Opal with Howard's sickness, or the sickness that he's worried about, or the sickness that he had and then it goes away. It's just this idea that that's deep inside of him, like the beauty of this gem and the possible cause of his death are both the same thing, and they're put together, and they're deep down inside him. And when we go into the Opal and we come out, a colonoscopy video, and then we see him at work, and so we kind of get this more ethereal, less practical understanding of who he is and what drives him, and then we get this really hands-on, tactile illustration of how that takes form. Just him walking around, him offering waters and trying to sell, and everything that he does, offering waters to the raspiest voiced person ever who says they don't want any water.
I love that guy and his turtle, his like light blue turtleneck. He might be like my favorite of the Uncut Gems supporting cast, of which it's a stacked all-star team, you know?
It's great, but there is that might be the secret weapon of this
Oh,
movie.
he's
Like,
incredible. He's
like
incredible.
when he's on the phone and inside that little man trap thing at the shop, and then comes out, and he's just resigned to, like, there's nothing that could happen now to undo what's been done, and he's just kind of seething. And there are moments of high energy and stuff, but he does a lot of just like, there's some tumult in this guy that is just like, we're not going to speak about this. And everyone who knows him has seen him do something absolutely wild, and you just know to fear him.
Oh, exactly. And just as an actor, he has the charisma you need to be the lead heavy in a movie, you know, which just not a lot of people have. Like, I don't know. It's just, there's something just so compelling about him. I want him to be in every action movie I see for the rest of my life. And he would crush it every time, you know?
I know. Even when he's getting pushed around by Kevin Garnett's huge bodyguards, you're like, I'm still more scared of this little, like, this smaller person for sure. Like, I don't, I'm absolutely frightened of him.
Anyway, I cut you off. Howard was offering waters that nobody ever really wants, but he's passing them out
Oh
for.
yeah, no. That's just what I was getting at. You get this. I think that it's just this impossible thing, and it's been, you mentioned There Will Be Blood, a perfect example. Like, there are just these. It's the motivating factor behind a lot of these dark, very often men throughout cinema who just have this unquenchable thing inside them, and this is this title is just the metaphor for what it is that drives this particular one.
So I guess we should talk about Howard in general, because the thing that really jumped out to me talking, and we've sort of mentioned it, you just did, like, he just sort of seems very unconcerned with people unless they're actively in a position to help them. And I include his family in that. I include Julia in that, who is the person he's the nicest to most frequently, which I know isn't saying much. But even when, he thinks that maybe he has an opportunity to get back with his wife, however foolishly, when she's wearing the bat mitzvah dress, he calls Julia trash. She's trash, and it's just like she becomes a way for him to help his position with Dina. And I'm sure there's an example of him saying something similar about Dina to Julia, it doesn't really even seem like he cares all that much about anybody. And the only time he cares about somebody is when they are in a position to help him. One of my favorite things about this movie, or favorite little moments in this movie, is when I think it's at the casino after Julia's placed the bet. They're talking on the phone. It's before the basketball game has started. And as they're hanging up the phone, Julia says, "I love you," and Howard does not. And I think that's sort of a, he just hangs up the phone. He doesn't say goodbye, nothing. It's just like, yep, conversation over. Great. Moving on. Go KG. And I think it's stuff like that that is just, he's just so, and I think part of the thing that impresses me about Adam Sandler's performance in this movie is because Howard on paper is just so unlikable. And somebody this unlikable, you can't watch a movie about unless the person in charge of playing them is able to make unlikable likable, and or at least compelling. And he absolutely does that. And Howard, when you just think about all of the things about him as a person, he's just such a shitty dude. And like what I was saying earlier about how he kind of talks to himself, or if he's just walking and saying things, that to me, that conveys the idea of somebody assuming people around him care about his every thought. Like he's just saying stuff because he assumes other people care what's going on with him. When he has the fight with Julia outside of the elevator, and he steps into the elevator that is full of people, he turns to them, he's like, "You have no idea." Like, that's just the most like self-absorbed shit that you could possibly do. If you're making any sort of reaction in that situation, like, well, one, a normal person wouldn't. Two, a very embarrassed person would be like, look around and like shrug, and then that's the best you can do. What he does is just like the
Or maybe
most,
apologize.
yeah, also that. And just in general, like, I mean, also he's the villain of that scene for sure. And like the just his reaction is so self-obsessed. And he makes his living taking bets on other people's work. And going back to that last scene with Kevin Garnett and Howard together, where they're in his office with, which Kevin Garnett is, I think Kevin Garnett's very good in this movie. The vast majority of the time, he's only playing himself, with, it seems like a lot of improv happening, like Howard asking early in the movie, asking KG who would win in a fight, Ben Wallace or Tony Allen. Like, that's something that Kevin Garnett's going to be able to handle, and I know that line was improv. So it's like, Kevin Garnett's going to be able to answer questions about Tony Allen off the top of his head for the rest of his life. That's not hard for him. But the scene where they're having a sit down, Kevin Garnett's like, "Yo, I want to talk to you for a second." That's his scene of real acting, and I think he's incredible in it. And they're talking about how much he paid for the opal. He's like, "I've already given you the money. I don't care. I just want to know," And they're having this argument. I mean, not like a yelling argument, but a discussion about how Howard paid $100,000 for it, and thought he could get $1 million for it. And his justification of of white. He paid that as like, oh, that's like 50 lifetimes over there. Keiji's response is, yeah, I'm saying a million is more though, you know, like, and it, yeah. It's such an honest, honest, like a reaction. And, Howard just doesn't see where Keiji's coming from. He would never stop to think about it because he's already thinking about how he's going to bet the money he owes his father-in-law on Kevin Garnett's performance at a basketball game later that night. And it's just like, it's just somebody playing with money until they no longer have money to play with. And what happens is he's lying on the ground of his jewelry store floor, having been shot in the face, you know, and like he won the bet, but like eventually the luck can still run out, even if you're still winning bets. And it's just, I don't know. I think it sort of really felt like watching capitalism, you know, like it's just, we're just building stuff on top of stuff. And it's like, we have no savings because we don't need savings because everything's always going to be okay. And it's just like, that's just a foolish place to approach your life from. And and sometimes you get shot in the face, you know, like, I don't know. It's just, I think that's sort of the core of Howard is watching the worst aspects of capitalism at work, you know?
Yeah, and the brief concern he shows when it seems like they're sending thugs to his house, yes. You know, where his young children, you know, even if if he doesn't care about his ex-wife anymore, that's still awful, but like, or I guess wife, it's all monstrous to still not, just how quickly he gets over the imminent danger or maybe death that they're facing while he's cheering on a basketball game.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, this movie ends, but it's not like everybody in his orbit is safe, you know, like his family's probably unsafe. Julia's definitely unsafe. And you know, it's just like, I mean, his life ends, so the story ends, but it's not like his actions don't have any reverberations at all, you know. I don't know. There's still a world without him, basically. And that's something that he doesn't really grasp throughout this movie. And I mean, he never grasps because he dies before he has an opportunity to gain some perspective. But I think that's sort of the core idea of this movie is that there's a world existing without you. And just because you're doing all these reckless things doesn't mean the people around you are unaffected by them, you know?
Yeah, and just a misalignment of priorities. You would assume he would rather, you know, if asked at any point in his life, would you rather live to see 60 with a middle income or be shot in the face trying to chase like a seven-figure lottery bet? You know, it seems like any human or any living creature would take longevity and comfort over ups and downs and heart attacks and then endangering those around you and then a quick death by bullet to the face.
Howard would probably figure out a way to take the older option and then somehow bet against him, you know, like it's like
parlay it.
Yes. I want to parlay it with KG's over. It's a bet that takes 20 years to pay off because it takes him that long to reach 60.
Parlay it with Wayne Diamond's hair length.
Is that the guy who's a cartoon character?
Yeah.
Okay.
This movie's secret weapon.
Oh man. Well, you know have you heard the story about how he's in the movie?
I don't think so.
So the Safdies have a joint Twitter account, which is the most Safdies thing possible. And around the time when this movie came out, because he was the person where, you know, because he shows up so late in the movie, he sort of comes out of nowhere, and he's just, as that one guy in the casino says, he's a cartoon character. While they were shooting in the casino one night, either Josh or Ben couldn't sleep and went down to play craps and met him playing craps, and we're just like, this guy is in the movie now. and so they put him in the movie, and like, that's what I'm talking about with the Safdie sort of impulsiveness and being open to the world around them. And it's just like, that's the type of like creative chance that is so, it takes such an unbelievable amount of confidence to be like, to see that person and be like, this person fits in my movie, you know, like, because I don't know. There's just, I can't even figure him out. It's a human nexus. But I don't know, it's so interesting. And again, like, this is a movie only two people could make, and they're related, you know? And there's it's a one of one, you know?
Absolutely.
And it's always impressive to find a movie that is so unique, and I love it. And it'll be the only movie I can think of like it until the Safdies make another movie. So,
Okay, we'll podcast about that one
Which actor that I don't hate, don't like, can they cast as the lead in that?
then.
We'll figure it out. Time will tell. Anyway, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Mode.